Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
Plus, you can always listen to all of our episodes, old and new, on the Broadway Podcast Network, iTunes, and Spotify.
Today's guest is one of the most recognizable actors working in the United States. Yes, we have seen this tall drink of water in such TV shows as Elementary, Veep, and The Good Wife, and movies like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Igby Goes Down, and Die Hard with Avengers. But this past president of Actors Equity has been a staple on the stage for over four decades.
That's right. He has been seen in such shows as My Fair Lady, Very Good Eddie, Phantom of the Opera, Les Miserables, the musical comedy Murders of 1940, Network, Doubles, and Catch Me If You Can, just to name a few.
And that's only a few, folks. To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Hal Prince, Rex Harrison, Arthur Penn, Professor Irwin Corey, and Jack O'Brien, here is the author of Climbing Rejection Mountain, the one and only Nicholas Wyman. Nick, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty good, Rob. How are you doing?
Doing so good. Nick, tell us about this book.
The book is sort of, I've been a mentor to younger actors for a long time, and I've also sort of like focused on the idea that it's a tough business and, you know, you never know whether you're going to make it or not, so don't give up. But also that you can improve your odds by, you know, a few techniques, a few tricks of the trade, and also just an approach to life that will make, you know, serve you well, whether you're an actor or not. I mean, just in terms of like, you know, getting from one day to the next, 1 year to the next, and feeling good about it. So that's the book.
So folks, we'll post a link for this, obviously, in the show description so you can buy a copy of it. So Nick, let's go all the way back. Where did you grow up and when were you first on stage?
I was born in Maine. We lived there for like 3 years, but I grew up in New Jersey, about, you know, 15, 20 miles west of New York. And the first time, I think the first time I was on stage was in seventh grade. I was playing Benedict Arnold. I was playing villains even then.
Right.
And the girl I was interested in, Nancy McEwen, played my wife. That was very, very nice. And we did this like little scene or something, or little playlet for our history class in seventh grade. And at the end of the thing, I die, and Nancy pulls the blanket up to cover my face. And as she pulled the blanket up to cover my face, it uncovered my feet because I was still very tall then. And we got a laugh from the class, and I thought, this is what I want to do for a living.
Oh, I love that. Now, what did your folks do?
My dad was a salesman. He sold carpets, and then he sort of segued into doing marketing for carpet companies, and then started his own advertising agency. And then while he was over in Europe, this was sometime after my parents divorced, because while he was married to my mom, he was never successful. So we were always living hand to mouth. But he discovered this product over in Germany that he called Rughold, which was this interstitial sort of like rubber-coated string checkerboard that you put under rugs and keeps them from moving around. My mom was a housekeeper, but she was very smart. And when we were grown, she went back to law school. She became a lawyer. And she was worked for a big law firm in New York City, Skadden Arps, and then she became counsel for Columbia University for a while. And
oh my gosh.
That's what she did.
What was it like when you decided to, you know, leave high school, go to college, and were you going to pursue acting in college?
No, no, definitely not. No, I was going to be, I thought I was going to be a lawyer when I went to college. I thought I was going to go to Yale and study psychology and become a lawyer. And I went to Harvard and I studied English. And I thought, after thinking for a while, I'd be a law professor. And I thought, no, I'm going to be an English professor. And that was my plan. Mm-hmm. I was going to be an English professor. And then the English department at Harvard said, no, you're not going to be an English professor. In fact, you'll be lucky if you graduate. So I decided, well, if it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a tough hill to climb back up to be in academia. I thought, well, if it's going to be so hard to be, you know, an English professor, I'll go be an actor. Because that sounded like more fun, but it was always going to be hard. So I thought, well, that make this course is going to be hard, I'll go be an actor. So I went to acting school in New York City at the Circle in the Square, which was a one-year program at the time. I didn't want to do one of these four-year programs. So I thought, I don't want to spend 4 years more in school. While I was there, they added a second year to the program. So I stayed for a second year at Circle in the Square. But going there was enabled me to sort of like learn New York City and the business while I was learning my acting. And then I started working, and I've been fortunate enough to be working ever since. So,
tell us a little bit about what it was like to be at Circle in the Square at this time. Who were some of your teachers, any fellow students that you remember?
Nico Sakharopoulos, who was the head of the Williamstown Theater Festival and a teacher at Yale.
Would you tell us a little bit about him? Because I know he was so influential in so many other actors, and I think you might be the first person on our show that's had some interaction with him.
Nikos was he was a big deal because he was the head of Williamstown, and he had worked with, you know, all these people, Blythe Danner and Frank Langella, whatever, at the beginning of their careers. There's always this sense of like, I don't know, that we weren't quite measuring up to his level of, you know, of students, whatever. Nikos had this habit. He would rub his shoulder, his chest, you know, under his shirt like this with his one arm and go, "That's right, sweetheart. Yes, that's right." He was an expert. He was a whiz on Chekhov. That was his sweet spot, his bailiwick. And so you pick your life in your hands to do a Chekhov scene in front of him because he knew his stuff. He was very useful in terms of, like, you know, making you specific and figuring out how to do things for real as opposed to for fake. When I was there from the fall of 72 until the spring of 74. Mm. And this was the first year that they had moved uptown. Then they took over the space underneath next to what was then the Eurus Theater, now the Gershwin Theater. And they had, I mean, I still remember, you know, it was, the building was brand new. Brand new. I can remember that they just were laying the carpet, which was this had this pattern of circles and squares, and I stole a little chunk of it to make an 8x8 chessboard with it. You were right there in the middle of the Broadway area, and that was useful. I was living in my grandparents' apartment. My grandparents had this classic six room apartment on Washington Square. And because my grandfather was well-to-do. My grandmother recently died. My grandfather found the place too, and it was filled with too many memories for him. So he was living with my mother out in New Jersey. And so I was living in this six-room apartment. My best friend from college came to New York, and he went to law school, and after a month he quit to come to New York to be an actor. So he came to New York and joined me. And the two of us lived there in this, you know, unbelievable six-room apartment over Washington Square. So I didn't have to make money for rent, but I did have to, you know, buy groceries. So I had a job as a ticket broker at Golden LeBlanc, Golden Pen Theater Tickets. It was in the back in the days when the Helen Hayes Theater and the Morosco, and before they were torn down, next to them was this little theater ticket agency called Golden LeBlanc. And we had little theater desks in every hotel, all the big hotels in New York. And people will come up to the theater desk and say, "I'd like to get tickets for a show. What do you have?" And they would say, we have blah, 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 blah. And then the theater desk would call us at this office. And we would say, "We don't have anything for that. Ship to, you know, Prisoner of Second Avenue." and we would be sitting around this table with a like Lazy Susan of theater tickets on for various shows and in slots and everything. And so that's what I did for like, you know, 4 hours a day. Consequently, I was able to get, you know, comped and do off-Broadway shows. So I saw a bunch of shows down at the Mercer Arts Center, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Danny DeVito and Dr. Sullivy's Magic Circus and a bunch of other things that were, you know, around at the time.
Was your interest in both plays and musicals at this time? Did you prefer one over the other, you know, one genre of theater?
No, I didn't. I mean, I had done both plays and musicals in high school and in college. Right. Like all acting students, I went to acting school and I thought, well, I'm a serious actor and I'm going to do, you know, Chekhov and Williams and Miller and Shakespeare and whatever. Mm-hmm. And you get out and you realize, oh, there's no money in that. And so I ended up doing musicals. So, but I've done both during my career. So
right.
That's
right.
That's been nice. I enjoyed both. I mean, I enjoy telling the story. I enjoy having a character that goes someplace. I enjoy having a catharsis as a person and an actor on stage. And you know, engendering such in an audience, we hope. There is something about musicals where, I mean, music can take you places where just words can't. So that's wonderful. And I enjoy doing that.
Do you remember the first Broadway show you ever saw?
The first Broadway show I ever saw was I Never Sang for My Father with Hal Holbrook.
Oh my gosh.
And I was up and, you know, plastered to the back wall at the second balcony, something like that. You know, it wasn't one of these things where I thought, oh, yes, that's what I want to do. No, it's just, okay, so I'll play. I had seen, you know, plays before. My father used to do community theater. I can remember seeing him play Major Metcalf in The Mousetrap.
Oh!
So, you know, I had some sense of acting as a thing people did, you know, not for money necessarily, but them.
It sounds like your family was supportive of you going into this world. Is that correct?
Okay. I can remember when I got... the lead. I played Sid Sorokin in the Pajama Game in high school. I came home and told my mother, and she said, "Oh, and you have songs?" I said, "Yeah, I have 5 songs." She said, "Really?" Because she didn't think I could sing. I got a bunch of scholarships to go to Harvard, but my dad paid for the rest of the tuition, which was in today's. I mean, it was tuition, books, and whatever totaled about $5,000 a year back then. But after I left Harvard, went off to Circle in the Square, and my dad was like, you know, I just paid for this. You're going to throw all that. And then he saw me do Kilroy in Camino Real, Tennessee Williams, Camino Real. And my dad came and saw it, and he said, afterwards, I think you made the right choice.
When you graduate from Circle in the Square, did they do any sort of, you know, showcase to help you meet agents, or did you have to just start pounding the pavement on your own?
No, just, you know, went out and looked for stuff on your own. Once I graduated, I got a job in summer stock making up to $70 a week.
Up to?
Yeah. If you were playing the lead, you got $70 a week. If you're playing, you know, a chorus, you got $35 a week.
And where was this summer stock?
This was in Allentown, Pennsylvania. It was a one-year thing, played for just 1 year. It was called Crackersport. And then I came back to New York after that. And then I went to an audition for Grease. And, you know, I was, number 8,000,000,045 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And as I handed my sheet music or whatever to the piano player stood up and turned to the auditioner and said, "I saw this fellow this summer play Paul in Carnival. He was wonderful."
Oh.
You know, but they put down their sandwiches and they sort of like, you know, leap through the... found my, you know, picture and resume, and they listened to me, and then they sang my number, and then Pat Birch came up and put me through some moves or whatever, and I got my first Equity job, which was covering Danny Zuko and 3 other roles in a touring production of Grease.
Remember what you sang for the audition, by any chance, or what were your, or even what your go-to songs were when you made the rounds?
Her Face. I used to sing Her Face, you know, from Carnival. A fair amount.
Oh, great.
So, yeah, so that was my first Equity job, and I got my Equity card, and, you know, I actually went on a couple of times, mm-hmm. And I came back to New York, and I got cast in a tour of 1776 as Jefferson, a national tour, and I also got cast in a couple of shows up at Goodspeed,
one
of which was a new musical that they were hoping to take to Broadway called Cowboy.
Oh.
And the other was an old Jerome Kern chestnut called Very Good Eddie. Sadly, I had a bigger part in Very Good Eddie than I did in the new Broadway-bound musical, Cowboy. But and so armed with these two job possibilities, I took them to Stark Heseltine, who was an agent at Heseltine Baker, and I said, I would like you to negotiate my contract for these, would you? So, okay, you know, no work on his part, sure, he'll take a look at these things. And the production contract minimum at the time was $325. And he said, the most I can get you for the tour is $350. So you'll earn less than minimum when you include my commission. But I think the best thing for you to do is do this thing up at Goodspeed, which will pay you slightly less. But maybe this cowboy thing will come in, and you know, you'll be seen by people and keep you close to New York. So I took the Goodspeed job, and Cowboy did not come to New York. But Very Good Eddie was a big hit up there. And finally, in the last couple of weeks, David Merrick came up, and David Merrick agreed to produce the thing. So we went to New York, and we opened in December of 1975 at the Booth Theater. And so Charlie Rapley and Virginia Seidel were two stars of this thing, and they were wonderful.
Our listeners love obscure shows, so I'm going to ask you, Nick, what was Cowboy or Cowboys about?
Cowboy, it was about Frederick Russell, the cowboy artist. It had some wonderful music, but the plot was sort of like, didn't really grab you where you, I don't know what the hell the conflict was. I mean, you know.
So that's what that one was about. Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
Good to know. So obscure listeners out there, if you love an obscure show, find a score to Cowboy. Why do you think Very Good Eddie was so successful? Because this was at a time when we had things like A Chorus Line and Chicago and all of Sondheim shows. Why did this little chestnut succeed?
Yeah. Bill Guile was, I think, nominated for a Tony for Best Direction. And the other three nominees were Hal Prince for Pacific Overtures, Bob Fosse for Chicago, and Michael Bennett for a Chorus Line.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty good company. My God. Okay.
It was and is an unbelievably charming show. And it was, beautifully directed by Bill and wonderfully played by Charlie and Virginia, who were just like adorable. And it had this, this quaint, cute sort of like dancing stuff that people did, and this old timey sort of plot, and it was funny, and just charming. It was an adorable little Valentine of a show, and you know, if you wanted a sweet good time in the theater, you had a great time there. You know, it wasn't breakthrough or challenging. Certainly, you know, it was just it was just fun.
Nick, what do you look for out of a director? For you, what's the ideal actor-director relationship?
You want someone who creates a safe space, who is supportive, who makes you feel like, if I try something, I'm not going to be eviscerated for ruining a show. You want someone who is not going to like call you out in front of the rest of the cast. I'd like to have somebody who's listens to my point of view. I like somebody who has a sense of humor. it's mostly about creating a good atmosphere in the room where you feel safe, where you feel like we're having fun, we're having a good time, and we're supported, and we're all in this together, and it's a family atmosphere, and we're working together, and we're doing what we can. It helps if you've got somebody who's really insightful about the character and the period and that sort of stuff. Helps if you have somebody who's like, a comic genius who has great bits for you to do. I still remember John Carey when I was doing Les Miserables, and the Thénardiers break into the wedding, and they're about to make their getaway having stolen the silver, and it falls on the floor, and John gave me the bit where you look at it on the floor and then look up at the ceiling and say, oh my God, it must have fallen from the sky.
Now, let me ask you, how do you deal in a situation where you and the director are not on the same page? How do you get through that?
Ultimately, I'm there at the service of the playwright and the director. Mm-hmm. And I'm there to serve their vision. And if my vision is not the same as their vision, well, then I need to sort of put my vision aside and do their vision. I mean, sometimes if you're really convinced that, no, this is the way this has to go sort of thing, you can try and edge things towards your ideas, but it's not my show. It's never my show when I'm the actor. You know, it's the playwrights or the directors, if you will. You know, frequently, I have a exalted opinion of, you know, of my opinion. Yeah. And it's not always correct. I mean, there are times when I think, you know, oh, this is the way it's supposed to go. And no, it's not. That's not helpful, Nick. It's actually, you know, so I try and be humble and just, you know, do what the director wants.
As an actor, what is your process in creating a character, if there is a process? Do you sit down and go, okay, beat for beat, here's what's happening? Or do you instinctually go into rehearsal, feel it out? How do you like to work?
I think I have a conceptual sense of what the play is about and where this character fits in, who this character is and what the character wants and what the purpose of this character is, blah, blah, blah. And there's a certain sort of, for whatever psychological, you know, childhood reasons, I have an ability to sort of suss out what people expect or want. You know, I think it was the fact that I moved 10 times by the time I was 10 years old, and I sort of like, you know, so I was always in a new classroom, a new school system, and sort of had to figure out, okay, the way things go here is, you know, and this is what I need to be doing it, you know, and stands me in good stead taking tests. I'm a killer test taker. I mean, because I know what the test person wants as an answer, so I can give you that. So I'm very good at giving you the obvious choices, which makes me a nice mediocre actor.
No. And
I try and move beyond that because what I admire in other actors is bold choices, mm-hmm. and things that are, you know, surprising,
right.
And truthful. And I think what I look for is, you know, what's going on before a scene starts, like, you know, where's that actor coming from, that character coming from? And I look for the forks in the road, the changes of direction in a scene where you're heading one way and then something happens and you're heading a different way. Mm-hmm. Or something happens and it sets off some emotional reaction in you. So you know, instead of being friendly, now you're angry or whatever. So that's the stuff I look for.
Do you like to do table work, or is that something you'd rather just get on your feet and experiment?
No, I enjoy doing table work. I don't want to do table work for a week and a half. It's useful because you can get ahead of yourself if you're just, you know, up on your feet and doing things. And it's much easier when you're at the table to stop and say, why do I say that? I mean, that doesn't seem to follow what the other person said. I mean, do we know what the relationship, these guys have, you know, all those questions that you ask the playwright or the director. So yeah, no, I enjoy doing table work.
But not for an extended period of time, because I know there are some rehearsals where
at a certain point I get bored and I want to move up on my feet and start making
to create.
Yeah. Now, tell us a little bit about how Phantom of the Opera came into your world.
Well, I got an audition to play one of the managers, and they wanted to hear an aria, an operatic aria.
Oh.
So I prepared Eri Tu from Un Ballo in Mascara, and I sang that. And then they called me back and had me prepare the Prima Donna, the intro to Prima Donna and Prima Donna. And, you know, the managers could be 25, they could be 55, right. They could be 65, you know, and they need to be sort of baritones. But other than that, they don't need to be like, you know, unbelievable basses or unbelievable tenors. They just, you know, so it's like, you just need two guys.
Right.
So it's like, you know, it's like, you know, they had their pick of 4,000, you know, equity actors in New York. You know, and somehow I got in the winnowing down part of it. Now, part of it was because, and I think a large part in my favor was that I replaced Kevin Kline as Bruce Grant on the 20th Century. So I worked with Hal before. And for the most part, Hal picked a bunch of people that he had worked with before. But anyhow, it was me and 30 or 40 of the, you know, top, you know, leading men, character men, whatever, in New York at the Royal Theater auditioning. And they would mix and match us. And I did some funny stuff with my my thing, sort of like, you know, getting down on a knee and pulling the other Andre down to a knee with me to, you know, plead with the prima donna. And Hal liked it. And they started, when in the mixing and matching, it became, Wyman and, you know, so-and-so, Wyman and, you know, so-and-so, and eventually became Wyman and Grovendahl. And it was cool because it was a huge, you know, hit in London, and we knew it was going right. to be a huge hit here. And it was somewhat discouraging. Cameron McIntosh knew people wanted to do it, so he was offering, you know, I'll give you 45 cents to do the show. You know, so I was like disgruntled that, and he also wanted to pay Chris Grovendahl and me the same amount. Insisted on that. Said that, you know, two managers, they get the same amount. It's favored nations with the other manager. You have to have the same amount. And I'm going to bill you. So you have the same billing, but because Chris Grovendahl comes before Wyman, it'll be Chris Grovendahl, Nicholas Wyman. And I thought, whoa. he's done like, you know, two shows. I've done like, you know, eight shows on Broadway. And, you know, and I've done films, you know, I've done television. And they would say, yes, but he's worked with the New York City Opera and he's done, you know, recordings. And I'm like, no, okay. No, I'm like, oh, come on. Nick Wyman's bigger than him. No, that's the billing. And that's the money. Well, say, I won't do it. Chris Grovendahl said, okay, I'll take that money. Whatever mm-hmm. it was, like $12.50 a week. And I said, I'm not going to take that. No. You tell them it has to be at least, I don't know what, $1,500 or $1,750 or something like this. So eventually they came up to my figure and raised. So I helped Chris Grovendahl get another $250 or whatever a week.
Oh, nice.
But you got to get flipping around when later on they asked Chris to understudy Raoul.
Oh,
Chris said, okay, I'll do it, but I'm not going to do it for free. You have to give me another $100. So they gave him another $100 and I got another $100. So,
yes.
So there we go.
Oh my gosh. That's great.
Hello, this is Eartha. When life is not monotonous, it is lovely, especially when I listen to Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, starring the Batman and Boy Wonder of podcasts. That's Rob and Kevin David to you. I head over to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, and give generously to them. Don't give it to Lady Bird. Don't give it to me. Give it to the boys, or you'll regret it when it ends. Patreon is perfect.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
When did you first get involved with Actors Equity in terms of a board position, in terms of being on the governing council, and why did you want to move into that world?
It actually was around the time of Phantom of the Opera. At the time, Cameron McIntosh wanted to bring Michael Crawford and Sarah Brightman. He wanted to bring them over as stars. Well, Michael Crawford, Actors Equity said, fine, he's a star. Sarah Brightman, no, she is not a star. And... Cameron McIntosh was like, she is the wife of the guy who wrote it. And I was like, no, she's not a star, you know. And there was this like pissy attitude about yes. Sarah Brightman because people who had seen her thought, you know, she's not very good. The same as, you know, she's sort of a simp, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So they didn't want to bring her over as a star. And there were two categories at the time where you could bring somebody over. One was they are star and H1. The other was they are H2. They are someone of extraordinary particular abilities. Well, I think being the wife of the composer is an extraordinary, you know, they should have taken that as the, but they didn't. And Hal Prince went and appealed to the Actors Equity Council, who turned him down. And
wow.
To this day, Hal feels a little miffed that, you know, that he came and was so gracious and they said, now. So Cameron McIntosh was making noises about, you know, I'll take it to Toronto instead of New York and, you know, and the hell with you guys.
Right.
And, yeah. And when I heard this, I had already been cast. I was like, well, wait.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to. I need this on. And so I began to think, well, who are these people who are like messing with my livelihood here?
Right.
I want to know. So I joined the production contract committee and I joined the alien committee. And Patrick Quinn at the time, who was just a counselor, said, you know, you should run for council. We need more working actors on council. So I ran for council and was elected, and I served on council for like another, I don't know, 20 odd years before I became president. And that's how I got involved. And it's a way of, you know, of being of service, of doing service, you know, being useful to my fellow actors.
And for Actors Equity, what does a council member do? What did you do for those 20 years?
Right.
At the time, we used to meet, I think, two or three times a month, like just about every Tuesday, we would meet, have a council meeting about what was going on, and you would rule on various requests to, you know, waive a particular rule. You would validate, vet whatever, you know, some contract that had been negotiated. Lots of things were ruled on by council at the time that have since become part of the local regional councils.
Do you remember the most contentious thing or the most controversial thing that came across, you know, your desk in the 20 years, not as president, but as part of the governing council?
Yeah, it would have been a similar thing with the alien issue of Jonathan Pryce. As a star.
So you were there for that. Okay.
And Jonathan Pryce, I had seen him in Comedians. He was brilliant in this show, Comedians. On Broadway, and I think he won a Tony. So he basically fulfilled the whatever the requirements were for being a star. I mean, he wasn't a name in the sense that no one in Kansas or Indiana, or whatever, was going to come to New York to see Jonathan Pryce. But he was in terms of this alien issue, he was a star. But he wasn't Asian, and the character is supposed to be, you know, Eurasian, and we wanted them to consider, indeed hire somebody of Asian American ancestry. Cameron McIntosh was like, no, this is the guy. He's like, won awards. He's brilliant at this role. I want him in this role. So Actors Equity, sort of in a vote of solidarity with actors of color and particularly Asian American actors, refused and said, no, we're not going to admit him as a star. And Cameron McIntosh called their bluff and said, well, then fine. I won't bring the show up. And then Actors Equity, rather, you know, humiliatingly had to go back and then re-vote and allow him in. The thought process, I mean, my thought process at the time was, I mean, I voted no, don't let him in, because I knew, well, Cameron McIntosh will just appeal this and he's going to win the appeal and a walkover. I mean, it's clearly a case where Jonathan Pryce qualifies, but we will have, you know, taken our moral stand, our ethical stand or whatever, in solidarity with our, you know, our Asian American brothers, and you know, fought the good fight, but we lost. Cameron McIntosh was too smart for that. He called our bluff, and we had to, like, you know, crawl back to the table and say, okay, you can bring him. And so that was, I mean, we looked bad on every conceivable way. I mean, we looked bad to the Asian Americans, so we said yes, and we looked bad to the producers, and because we were trying to, you know, stop the show from coming over. I mean, it was a mess.
A lose-lose situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Then what prompted you from going on these committees to being the president?
In 2006, Alan Eisenberg retired, and we needed a new executive director. And Patrick Quinn put his hat in the ring to become executive director. And after, you know, a few votes, other people said, yeah, he'd be a good executive director. I have no idea whether it would have been a good one or not. But he was, you know, elected, whatever, by council, and consequently, Mark Zimmerman, the first vice president, became president. And before he could actually take over as executive director, tragically, Patrick died of a heart attack. And so we had sort of like a triumvirate of of executives working as executive director for a year, and we hired a guy named John Connolly, a very good buddy of Mark Zimmerman's, to be executive director. And John had been active in AFTRA politics, and he was, you know, a savvy guy. And so Mark and John were, you know, a close team for 2 or 3 years there. And then in 2009, when Connolly's contract was up for renewal, council did not renew his contract. And Mark felt that he had personally pushed for John at the time and had pushed for him to be, you know, re-upped. And he felt, you know, sort of disregarded by council. So he quit. And Paige Price, who was the first vice president, she became president. And we had an election the next year for equity president to find the new president. Paige was at the same time artistic director of this theater Aspen out in Colorado, and felt like, whether it was or not, it certainly looked like a conflict of interest. So I thought somebody else should be president. Looking around the room, I thought, you know, probably should be me. So I threw my hat in the ring, and I was, you know, tabbed by the nominating committee, and I ran, and I was elected, and I served for 5 years. But I mean, it was, I had never had the ambition to be president. I mean, I thought, you know, that Mark would be president for, you know, I don't know, 15 years or something. And then one of the other guys would be president, you know, I'd just be the sort of class clown counselor in the back row of the room.
What does the president do for Actors Equity?
He is the figurehead. You know, you have an executive director who does all the, like, running the
right
the
business,
the staff, and who, you know, negotiates contracts. The president serves, you know, on most committees, is on the, you know, frequently on negotiating committees, serves as the representative of the union and to press, to other people in the industry, is the person that, you know, members go to with complaints and issues and whatever. I mean, Patrick was first vice president for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
18 years. No, 12 years, something like that. Anyhow, he served as first vice president under a number of presidents who were under Colleen Dewhurst and Ellen Burstyn and Ron Silver and other folks. And these people, you know, famous actors, were like, we're not involved in the day-to-day, you know, whatever. Patrick would be there doing stuff, but
right.
But when Patrick was president and when I was president, that was the person there doing all the stuff. So I would generally be, you know, in the office almost every day, responding to emails. I mean, got thousands of emails, and dealing with issues that came up for folks. I would be, you know, you chair the board meetings as the president. You serve on the board of trustees of the pension health committees.
Right. Was it hard juggling your acting career while still taking on this new role as, you know, a more political / business side? You know, were you able to still focus on acting?
Well, I mean, I continued to work. I didn't work as much as I had before, and I don't know whether that was a chicken and egg thing or whether just a coincidence. I don't know. I don't think I was blackballed in any way for being the president. It may have taken some of my focus away from preparing auditions.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, from what years did you serve? From
2010 to 2015.
Okay. So what were some of the things that at the end of your presidency you were proudest of?
I was proud of, I wrote a monthly column for the Equity News.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those things are in this book, this Climbing Rejection Mountain, that I thought were useful approaches to, you know, the membership in terms of championing them and reminding them to keep going, not to get discouraged. I mean, I explained things like touring the whole, in the early 2000s, Equity had broken its longtime policy of having, you know, one contract and one contract only for touring. That was the production contract, to having this short engagement touring agreement and then tiering the production contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I, you know, wrote a couple of columns explaining the logic behind this and how this works and how this made sense both for the producers and for the actors. That we had, what we had done was not like taken, you know, these production jobs and made them into these lower paying jobs. We had taken these non-union jobs and made them into lower paying union jobs.
Yeah.
I was also very proud of the year 2013 was our centennial year. Mm-hmm. And I went around the country and I spoke at every one of our centennial celebration, at every one of our 30 or so liaison cities. And I thought I represented the actors well.
Sorry. No, you did. So. From Kevin and I are both members of Actors Equity and very proud of your administration and everything that you did. You know, one of the things that gets asked a lot, I think, amongst actors is there ever going to be a point where equity also goes under the SAG-AFTRA umbrella now that they're together? What are your thoughts on that?
I've always thought that it should be the Canadian model, that you should have screen actors on one side and live actors on the other, that you would have SAG and AFTRA together on one side, and you would have Equity and AGBA and AGVA together on the other side, that people who do live shows, whether it's in opera or on, you know, Broadway or in cabaret or on cruise ships or whatever, that they would all be together. In England, you have a model where everybody's in the same union. British Equity covers everything. And historically, I have thought that's not a good model for us, because what film and TV and radio are about is money on both sides of the table. It's about money. And historically, you know, Equity and stage things on the other side of the table, that you would have these producers who, you know, cared about money, but they really wanted to, you know, put on a great show and everything. And you have the actors who are like, you know, I don't need to be paid. I just want to work, you know, as you have this issue in Los Angeles that caused such havoc. And I feel that in the universe of SAG-AFTRA, that Broadway would still get, you know, represented. That, you know, maybe, you know, Lord theaters, maybe off-Broadway, but all those little small professional theaters that, you know, that are paying people like, you know, $250, $280, $300 a week, that, you know, serve as a way to somehow get your actors your working week so you can get, you know, health coverage. That would be like, yeah, we don't care about that shit. That the members would not be represented well. The members, I think, feel that, you know, SAG-AFTRA is powerful and Equity is weak. And that if we had a powerful union, then we would get, you know, I think the powerful union is going to think, well, it's not worth our time. It's not worth, you know, it's not worth the manpower to spend, you know, to assign, you know, these staff members to work on these little tiny contracts. You know, if you wanted to go there, you know, I think it would not serve the members well. I think SAG-AFTRA is about commerce and Equity is about art, if you will, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think those low-paying contracts would not, and the members in general would not be well represented.
Now, were you, please forgive my ignorance, were you president during the Los Angeles showcase contract?
Yes, that is why I'm no longer president.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nick. I was going to ask you to expand on what exactly that was, so future generations can have an understanding of it.
You could write a book about this. You could have, you know, 10 podcasts about this.
Great. Well, okay.
Basically, what you have is historically, Actors Equity has been a New York centric union. Indeed, up until sometime in the early 80s, I would say, it was just New York. And then you had a Western Regional Council and then a Central Regional Council added. Up until then, you had, you know, just these advisory boards that would, like, you know, offer some point of view from these. But who cares about that shit? Because it's all about New York. But it is still very much about the business is very much centered in New York. The actors who work in all these regional theaters, they're generally hired out of New York. It's not necessarily, you know, useful or appropriate or right for the actors who live in Detroit and Dallas and Louisville or, you know, whatever, Seattle. But that's how it is. I have always been somebody who tried to, like, champion the actors who choose to live for whatever reason in other places. At a certain point, we were told by our legal counsel that our approach to theater in LA was probably illegal. That allowing some theaters to pay their actors, you know, this little gas mileage stipend of, you know, $7 a show or whatever, and then making other theaters pay $350 or $400 a week wasn't kosher. You know, you can't do that. And that members could sue for back pay. That actors were working for, you know, for less than minimum wage. And that we stood to lose a lot of money unless we changed our rules. And I'm not a lawyer. And this whole issue occupies a somewhat gray area. I mean, there are people on the other side who are firmly convinced that legal opinion was wrong and that we could have continued in the same way. That may be true. I don't know. But we tried to carve out exceptions. We tried to create a runway, a pathway towards paid work for actors in Los Angeles so that you would have all these gradations and steps towards being able to make money doing work in LA. We carved out exceptions where if you wanted to get together with a bunch of your friends and do a show, fine, not a problem. If you wanted to do work in the theater that would have 50 seats or less, not a problem. If you wanted to, and then, you know, at my insistence, they carved out this thing for membership companies that if you were part of a membership group company, whatever, that you could work with that membership group company without having to, you know, get an equity contract. But the thing that all this ran up against is the fact that people who are in LA are not in LA to do theater. They are in LA to become TV stars or to make a living doing television. Maybe they make a living doing film too, but it's mostly it's a TV city. That's what it's all about. And if they got a TV gig, an episodic, or God forbid, a pilot, they did not want to be tied down to an equity contract. Right. They wouldn't be able to say, hey, I got an episode of Manix next week. I'm out of here. So they didn't want, you know, they're happy to have the money, but they didn't want to be tied down to a contract. And that, I mean, the Antillas Theater Company deals with this by double casting every one of their shows. So that's when somebody gets a job, they just leave and the other person takes over. So this caused a huge stink because it was going to put a bunch of theaters out of business. Their business model meant they didn't pay the actors, and that's how they were able to pay their, you know, their executive, their artistic directors, and blah, 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 and frequently their directors, their lighting designers, their costume designers, their set designers. It was only the actors who weren't getting paid because the actors were happy to have the chance to like work on stage and exercise their muscles and everything, but they wanted to be able to drop at any time and go off to this. So we were setting up a thing where that was going to be lost to them. They were going to have fewer opportunities to work, and it made them unhappy, made them very unhappy. And despite, you know, my best efforts to explain this to them without getting into the legal ramifications, which is of course what was behind this, because he couldn't say that, because once that cat's out of the bag, then people are suing us and we're beginning. So it was a mess, exacerbated by the attitude of a bunch of people, a number of whom went on to serve as officers of the union in New York, who said, you know, hey, look, if they don't want to be paid for their work, then let them leave the union. Who cares about them? A very unpleasant attitude towards our members. So it took effect, and it remains that way today. You know, I have stepped away from equity, so I don't know exactly where things stand now. But I mean, that is the membership companies such as Antillas continue to work. Theaters that work under this 50 seats or less thing, and there are theaters that, you know, that pay actors. There aren't that many more. Maybe there are a couple more. But I mean, it's, you know, it has not been like a windfall of paying opportunities for actors in Los Angeles. You know, that is, it remains to this day, I mean, a place where you go to try and get TV work.
You know, one of the things that's come up recently with equity, and I'd love your opinions and thoughts on it if you're willing to share, is the changing of the EMC model to where it used to be 50 points, right? And then it became 25 points, I think. And now it's just, you can join the union if you've got some sort of proof that you've been paid to be an actor at some point in your career. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not really up on that. So you may know more than I do about where it stands. Initially, the idea was to sort of, you know, create this sort of journeyman sort of thing,
yes,
where actors, yeah, would, like, you know, learn their craft through experience, through, you know, working with other experienced actors. I think there's something to be said for that. There are those, you know, who have advocated over the years, you know, just open the membership to anybody and we will dry up the market. You know, they will force everybody to have to deal with equity. Well, no, you can open. You're always going to have people who don't want to pay the whatever it is, you know, initiation, or saying, well, I can still work with this thing without paying that initiation thing, and I don't need equity to represent me. I mean, there are people in all sorts of walks of life and various, you know, jobs who don't want to join unions for whatever reason. And the number of people who want to be actors versus the number of jobs is so out of scale. So, I mean, as it is with 52,000 equity members, 17,000 of whom work in any given year. So two-thirds of the membership don't work at all in any given year, at all. And of those 17,000 that actually do work, about half of them work enough to get some sort of health insurance. So really, you know, wacky, disproportionate buyer-seller sort of market. And you do not address that. In fact, you make it worse by, you know, letting everybody else into the union. What you do is you create, you know, tens of thousands more unemployed, unhappy equity members. I don't see that that solves the problem. So I don't know the rationale behind, you know, letting anybody into the union who has shown that they have, you know, been paid money. I think it has mostly to do with trying to address the terrible hit that equity took to its, you know, coffers during the pandemic.
Yeah.
I don't know, but that's my guess.
Nick, would you just give us just what's like a big thing that you've learned that you know now that you wished you knew when you first started out, or that maybe you wished students know as they're beginning their journey?
What I've learned is that everybody in the business is insecure. Mm-hmm. It is a business founded on insecurity. No matter how successful you are, you know, everybody's insecure. So just relax. Just relax. Don't think that, you know, everybody else has all the answers and you're the only one who doesn't really know what's going on. When you go into an audition, you think, oh my God, I hope I don't blow this. You need to know that the people on the other side of the table are thinking, oh my God, how am I ever going to find somebody for this spot? If I don't get the right person to play this role, you know, they're equally anxious. So just take a deep breath and do your best and let it go. And that's all you can do.
At what point in your career, Nick, did you think you personally learned that lesson?
I couldn't name a point. I think it's something that's come to me over the years. People such as, you know, I've done Broadway shows with Rex Harrison and Richard Dreyfuss, and you would think, well, these guys, they have it all. I mean, you know, they were both, and just about everybody else I know, you know, were like, you know, anxious as to whether they were going to get this right or not screw up and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's, we are all afflicted with this, you know, this fear that we're not going to meet our expectations, other people's expectations. And it's just, you know,
it's comforting to know that everyone goes through this. Nick, what's next for you besides selling this wonderful book? And once again, folks, if you go into our info description today, you can buy a copy of it. We'll send you the link to buy a copy of it.
I don't know. I mean, it's the wonderful news is that because I have been fortunate enough to work for, you know, 40 odd years in all sorts of ways, that I have not one, not two, but three defined benefit pensions.
Oh, yes.
Comes into my bank account, whether I work or not. I have Social Security that comes into my bank account so that I can pay my bills whether I work or not. So that's nice. You know, I spent 30 years on the governing board of Actors Equity, and my wife was sort of an equity widow. And so I've stepped away from that in an effort to like spend more time with her. And that's
good.
Spend more time with her.
Where did you meet your wife, Nick?
I was down in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at the Pittsburgh Public Theater in 1978. And I was doing Lenny at a Mice and Men. And the guy playing George and I were there a week early to work on the Lenny George scenes. And then the rest of the cast was coming in. There's only one woman in of Mice and Men. And this is before the age of Google and everything else. So I wanted to meet this woman. And I heard that, you know, we were all living in this renovated old Victorian house that had been broken up into six apartments. And I've heard that she didn't have enough light in her apartment. So I grabbed one of my standing lamps. I went downstairs and I knocked on her door and I said, "Lamp man." And she opened the door and I chatted her up. And that was Sunday evening, October 8th, 1978. And I moved in with her on Thursday. And we've been together ever since.
How beautiful is that?
And I said, every October 8th, I celebrate Lamp Man Day.
Forever the Lamp Man.
I love that.
Oh, that's amazing.
Nick, it has been such a pleasure and joy getting to talk to you today. Thank you so much, not only for giving us your time, but for being a fantastic president and representative of the union that Kevin and I are both proud members of. Thank you for that. I hope that we get to meet you in person one day to say thank you in person. But until then, we'll just keep enjoying all the beautiful work you are doing. Enjoy your time off with your wife, because both of you deserve it. That is for sure.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This was lovely. Yeah.
Thanks oh, good. Thank you so much. Thank you. All right, friends. Take care. Till next time.
Thank you for listening to today's episode, and a big thanks to the punchy players Jeff Marquis, who is bringing back Lucy, Betty, Judy, and Morda shill for us.
And a big thanks to our sound editor Daniel Schwartzberg and social media manager Bethany Ann Selecki.
And don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you come in.
In order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us just 1 star and you can make us feel as bad as Annie did in that really weird production in Boston where Annie dreamt that she was being adopted, but then she ended up back in the orphanage, right back where she started. Yeah, true story. Rob saw it.
Yes, and it was Betty. It was bizarre. I was there. I was.
Oh, good.
So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.